I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Sounds of celebration last night outside Cambridge City Hall in Massachusetts as gay couples lined up to apply for marriage licenses. Across the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, gay couples began exchanging marriage vows today, marking the first time a state has allowed same-sex couples the right to marry. The city of Cambridge opened its doors at midnight. Thousands of supporters and a few protesters showed up outside City Hall.
To my mind, this is one of the most patriotic events I think I have ever attended. I think this is really what the spirit of this nation is about, when gay people, straight people, black, white, Hispanic people can all come together and celebrate equality, and this step that Massachusetts is taking.
Paul McMahon.
Ralph Hodgson.
It's going to be our 49th anniversary of living together, and on the 29th of May is when we're planning to do it.
Yes, on the day that we met in Central Park in New York City in 1955.
I never thought I would live long enough to experience this, you know.
Actually, we never even dreamed that anything like this could possibly happen. It seemed like something that you didn't even fantasize about, and it's absolutely thrilling, and it means that all of these people are for us, and they can't stop us no matter what.
Ben Phelps, in a few minutes here now, they're going to start marrying same-sex couples. They're spitting in God's face. It's an abomination.
Now, does God not love homosexual people as well as straight people?
Ew, he hates them. He hates them. He hates all workers of iniquity.
I'm just showing that people of faith are also in favor of gay marriage, and it's not just the religious people that are against it. The Christian scripture says God is love. Love wins out over hate and fear and bigotry.
Oh my God. It's such a huge, wonderful celebration. It's so empowering to be here with everybody else. I wouldn't have done it any other way.
Right now, I'm overcome.
Tanya McCloskey and Marcia Kadish, both of Malden, Massachusetts, were among the first to receive an application for a marriage license. Then, shortly after 9 o'clock this morning, the couple exchanged vows, making them the first same-sex couple to be married in Massachusetts.
He calls of Tanya's, Marcia's name. Look at her and repeat after me. I give you this ring.
I give you this ring.
As a symbol of my promise.
As a symbol of my promise.
And now, by the power vested in me by the state of Massachusetts as a justice of the peace, but most important of all, by the power of your own love, I now pronounce that you are married under the laws of Massachusetts. You may seal this marriage with a kiss. And with that.
WBUR reporter Athena Desai is in Cambridge and was present for Tanya and Marcia's marriage. Athena, tell us, how did they come to be number one?
This couple was actually number 56 in line last night to get their application for a marriage license. And then early this morning, they went to probate court and got the three-day customary period waived so that they could get married as soon as possible. And there they were. They just fell into being the first couple in the nation to get married.
Yeah. Last week, the Archbishop of the Catholic Church here in Boston, as well as other politicians, told critics of same-sex marriage to be sad but not mad in one case, and to hold their criticism on this day. Have you seen many protesters?
I have not seen any protesters here at Cambridge City Hall this morning. Last night, when there were thousands of people in the street, mostly celebrating, there were maybe 5 to 10 protesters, but they were actually mostly from Kansas. They were from out of town, and it does seem like opponents are staying mostly quiet, at least in Cambridge. Mm.
You talked to the couple after their wedding, to Tanya and Marcia. What did they tell you about being the first to be married? Again, they sort of stumbled into it.
They are completely overwhelmed. They're totally honored and feel incredibly supported. They kept saying that they both felt full of love they themselves have felt married for the past 18 years that they've been together, but they are honored to be the first couple.
Athena, I hear some applause behind you now. Is there another couple being married?
There are. Every time a couple comes out of City Hall, there are a group of well-wishers just clapping and cheering for them. City Hall is handing out roses and cake to the people who are coming out. So it's a very celebratory mood here. Mm.
And again, most of those couples have just applied for a license. They will have to wait the 3 days.
Yes. Yeah. There will be a lot of weddings that will happen, ceremonies that will happen later on in the week. You should look for a big spike on Thursday, which would be the after the customary 3-day waiting period.
WBUR's Athena Desai in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Athena, thank you.
Thank you.
We turn now to WBUR reporter Rachel Gottbaum in Provincetown, Massachusetts. That town's Board of Selectmen was the only one in the state that voted to instruct its clerk to grant licenses to same-sex couples from out of state. And that was against the instructions of Republican Governor Mitt Romney. The governor had said that a statute from 1913 barred out-of-state couples from marrying in Massachusetts if the union would be illegal back in their home state. And he told town clerks to deny license applications to non-state residents. So the couples who got licenses in Provincetown had to drive to the nearby town of Orleans to get a waiver so they could get married today. Rachel, what's the scene there today?
There's been crowds lining up to get married. So far, maybe 50 or 60 couples have gotten their licenses, and maybe a dozen have gone out and gotten waivers so they can get married today. The town clerk had estimated at least a third were from out of state, and we just witnessed the marriage of Chris McCary and John Sullivan, who flew in from Alabama.
And then you were there at the wedding?
Yes. After they went to Orleans, they came back and got in their, you know, their business suits, and they looked wonderful. And they had their rings, and they were crying.
How big a crowd was it?
The only people that were there were the press. They were just going to do this on their own, and the only people that were there were the press. And they were touched. We were there.
Are some of these couples concerned about what happens when they go home, whether their marriages are going to be recognized as legal? Because certainly in Alabama, the attorney general was saying last November that that state wouldn't recognize same-sex marriages, even if the legislature issued a law to that effect.
Well, the way they see it is that this is going to be challenged in the courts and defined ultimately in the courts. So the way they see it is that this is the first step, and that eventually their marriage will be recognized.
Thanks, Rachel.
Thank you very much.
WBUR reporter Rachel Gottbaum reporting from Provincetown, Massachusetts. And as you just heard, Chris McCary and John Sullivan encountered few obstacles getting married in Massachusetts this morning, but the Attorney General of Alabama has already said that their marriage won't be recognized in his state. And Alabama isn't the only state not recognizing Massachusetts gay marriages. Today, Connecticut Attorney General Richard Blumenthal essentially agreed.
Same-sex couples cannot legally marry in Connecticut. The legislature has provided no authority for the issuance of marriage licenses to same-sex couples.
And joining us on the line now from Hartford, Connecticut, is Av Harris, Capitol reporter for WNPR. Hello, Av, and tell us, what else did the Attorney General say?
Well, I want to correct you just a little bit. What Attorney General Blumenthal said was that under Connecticut law, same-sex couples cannot get married here. But he has no opinion. He actually declined to answer the question from Massachusetts Governor Romney on whether or not a same-sex couple in Connecticut could go to Massachusetts, get married, and then have that marriage be recognized back in Connecticut. He actually says that he declines to answer that legal question, and that that will just have to be played out in the courts or whatever other local issues come up, whether it's inheritance or tax or health care related issues, that if a gay couple gets married in Massachusetts and comes back to Connecticut, that's something that's going to have to work its way through the legal system.
So in essence, because the legislature hasn't addressed this, then he just doesn't want to get into it?
Well, basically, because since Connecticut borders Massachusetts, Governor Romney wants to make sure that you don't have this flood of couples from out of state coming in, and he asked all the attorneys general to write to him and say whether or not Massachusetts can legally marry residents from Connecticut under Massachusetts law. And what Blumenthal was saying to Governor Romney was, I can't really interpret Massachusetts law, and also I don't have an answer for whether or not a gay couple in Connecticut who gets married in Massachusetts, that whether or not that marriage would then be recognized in Connecticut. I really can't tell you right now because there's not enough guidance from the legislature on this question.
Yes, it does sound as if a lot of these attorneys general are having to walk a very careful line here. Tell us about what gay activists in Connecticut are saying. I would imagine the anti-gay contingent is cheering the news, but what else are you hearing?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's a group called Love Makes a Family, and they've been pushing for legalization of same-sex marriage here for a while. They're cautiously optimistic by the Attorney General's opinion, because they're saying that in giving his in declining to answer the question to Governor Romney about whether or not a gay marriage would be recognized in Connecticut if it took place in Massachusetts, the Attorney General Blumenthal did not say that gay marriages performed in Massachusetts would automatically be void under Connecticut law. And that's an important point. It may be sort of a legal semantics question, but to them it's an important point because that means that there's a chance that that marriage by either a local judge, a probate court, some other institution may be recognized, and that's one step along the process to legalizing gay marriage.
We're also waiting to hear from Rhode Island's Attorney General. He's expected to rule that Rhode Island won't recognize gay marriages either. Does that surprise you at all?
Well, what I've heard is that Attorney General Patrick Lynch in Providence may take this cautious approach as well that Attorney General Blumenthal has here in Hartford. And I think it's probably a wise move because, like Attorney General Blumenthal said, there really isn't any guidance from the legislature, so he can't really make law and say, yes, gay marriages would be recognized here in Connecticut. He really has to interpret the law that the legislature creates, and I think this will put further pressure on legislators to put it into law, either if gay couples can get married, if those marriages can be recognized or not.
Do you get the sense that the Connecticut legislature is under some pressure here to get going on this, or they are not feeling obliged to have to act quickly?
Well, they tried to. This session, there was a push by some. There was some folks who are not supportive of gay marriage who brought up this Defense of Marriage Act, very similar to the federal legislation that would declare marriage to be only considered between one man and one woman, and there was a lot of talk about blocking that. That eventually was not voted on by the legislature, but everybody's saying that they're going to come back next session starting in February and really answer the question because, in a large way, because of the ambiguity that's created by the situation in Massachusetts. And
we'll have to leave it there for now, Av.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Av Harris is Capitol reporter for WNPR in Hartford, Connecticut.
Just ahead, Brown versus Board of Education. One civil rights attorney reconsiders his position of 50 years ago today.
And later in the program, a top Iraqi official has been assassinated in Baghdad.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
African-American civil rights lawyer Derrick Bell was ecstatic 50 years ago when the Supreme Court ruled in Brown v. Board of Education that segregated public schools were inherently unequal. But as the years have passed, Bell has reconsidered his original position. He writes about his changing views in the new book Silent Covenants, Brown v. Board of Education and the Unfulfilled Hopes for Racial Reform. And Derrick Bell joins us on the line from New York. Hello and welcome.
Thank you very much, Robin. Nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you. Professor Bell, you know, when people first hear your thinking, and we should say that this is radio, we don't presume that people know that you are a black man, you know, and I'm sure you've heard, the response. How can you say this?
Well, it's my response because there's always been a greater expectation for Brown than the decision could possibly have fulfilled. The fact is that segregation was race-based status, and when it was threatened by the court, the result was, as we probably should have expected, a massive resistance that prevented much of any implementation for a dozen years. And when persons like myself started finally getting court orders requiring school desegregation, even if it meant busing and racial balance, the response of many whites was simply to take their kids out of public school, put them in private schools, perhaps move far off to the suburbs, and thereby frustrate the major way in which we thought we could both desegregate schools and integrate the society. So that today, most blacks and Spanish background students, particularly those who are poor, remain in schools that are both segregated and inferior.
What else do you think went wrong? You speak in your book about concentrating, because of the decision, on numbers, in other words, numbers of students and equality of numbers of students in schools, as opposed to what kids were actually learning.
That's right. I think that we felt that once black kids were where white kids were, then black kids would get what white kids were getting. And in many instances, that was not very much. I remember in the Boston school case, for example, the parents and their committees said, you know, we're for desegregation, but we certainly don't want to send our kids to South Boston, where, in our view, the schools are worse than they are in Roxbury and in other black sections.
South Boston, a largely white neighborhood, Roxbury, a largely black neighborhood here in Boston. And that raised a question, because many people felt that this became an issue of black versus white, but it pitted poor families against each other. It should have been phrased as a question of economics.
Economics certainly goes into it, but race is also intertwined, because for many whites, the fact that they were poor, or at least not rich, was a consolation by the fact that they at least were white and they looked like the people with money, they looked like the people with power, they looked like the people with guns. So that the whites say in some parts, and I don't want to just pick on Boston, because it certainly happened in other areas, were very angry about blacks coming to their schools, far more angry than they were about the poor quality of the schools that their children were attending. So that what we didn't realize was the strength of the opposition to a school desegregation. And at some point, we should have remembered what W.E.B. Du Bois said in 1935. He said, black kids need neither integrated schools nor separate schools. What they need is education. So that's the message we didn't get, and the message perhaps the court could have more clearly conveyed had they said, okay, if you want to desegregate public facilities, buses and waiting rooms, then you bring a case about that. But as to public schools, we think that what is needed is not to strike down separate but equal, but for the very first time require its full enforcement, and we are prepared to do that.
In other words,
now, would that be an easy? Probably not. But the results might have been better, because the black schools prior to 1954 were not horrible. I think that was part of the argument. We have to get out of these horrible schools. The facilities were horrible, but often the teaching was first class, the parents were involved, and much of that got lost when we finally got orders requiring school desegregation.
Again, it became about race as opposed to about the quality of education.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now, this is tough for me to say since I handled so many of these cases.
I was going to ask you that. What was that moment of realization for you like when this is Brown v. Board of Education, one of the biggest moments in black American and American history?
Well, you know, after doing the litigation for many years and being totally consumed with it, and then as administrator down in Washington, also on school desegregation, I began teaching at Harvard, and I had a little more time for reflection, for reading, for looking back over what had been accomplished and what was likely to be accomplished. And I started writing about moving away from racial balance in busing and toward plans that focused on the effectiveness of education, even if in all black schools. And that was not well received by my former civil rights colleagues. Later, when the schools remained segregated, the courts were declaring them unitary because the segregation was a result of residential patterns and economic status. And then they came around and said, oh, well, Bell, I guess you were right. Well, that didn't give me any satisfaction, because the black kids were still in segregated schools that were, more importantly, bad schools. One of the things that the Brown celebration is worthwhile, one of the reasons it's worthwhile, is to give an opportunity to remember the courage of black parents and black kids who became plaintiffs in those cases, who risk economic retaliation, who risk physical violence, because they really believed that the law had spoken and that the country would conform. It didn't, but that doesn't take away from the courage that they exhibited.
Well, Derek Bell, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Derek Bell, visiting professor of law at New York University Law School, author of the new book Silent Covenants, Brown versus Board of Education, and the Unfulfilled Hopes for Racial Reform. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
A group calling itself the Arab Resistance Movement is claiming responsibility for this morning's suicide bombing that killed the president of the Iraqi Governing Council. Izzadeen Salim died when a car drove up alongside his vehicle as he approached coalition headquarters in Baghdad. Eight others were also killed in the attack. Meanwhile, the scandal around the abuse of prisoners in U.S. detention in Iraq appears to be moving right up the chain of command. Joining us on the line is Michael Hirsch, senior editor of Newsweek magazine. He's in Washington. Thank you, Michael.
Happy to be here.
Michael, let me start with this sarin bomb. This is, I believe, the first time we've seen sarin as a bomb ingredient. We're told that no one was hurt, but is sarin gas something that would have an immediate effect?
Yeah, it would. It appears to have had no serious ill effects on U.S. troops. No one was really injured. It's not clear what the provenance of the sarin is. It's a small amount. It doesn't seem to be evidence of any kind of a WMD program. It could have been imported. There's simply too many questions now to answer definitively, where this came from.
Well, in general terms, how ominous and how unexpected or not do you think this is?
Well, I think this is happening in the context, along with the killing of Salim today, of a ratcheting up of the insurgency leading up to the June 30 handover.
Any idea who might be part of this Arab resistance movement?
Well, I think, suspect number one probably has to be Zarqawi, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who, of course, is the man who was identified as beheading Nicholas Berg last week. He's also one of the most notorious terrorists operating out of Iraq. I don't think they've identified him as a suspect, but certainly he would have to be seen as part of this general effort.
I also want to ask you about the Cy Hirsch story in this week's New Yorker magazine, which details a policy of kind of anything goes in interrogations, that the United States was desperate for information about attacks on American forces, and the Hirsch article traces it from Afghanistan in terms of time and to the top of the Pentagon in terms of the chain of command.
Well, our own report in Newsweek is more detailed and has more extensive documentation of how this goes not back to just Rumsfeld, but to President Bush himself and a whole legal groundwork that was laid by the White House legal counsel, Alberto Gonzalez, to essentially circumvent the Geneva Conventions. In fact, we learned in Newsweek this week, and it's published in our story, that the president himself, by January 2002, had already decided to ignore the Geneva Conventions in dealing with Taliban and al-Qaeda. That was later partially changed after Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, intervened. But what we have here is a pattern going back to the beginning of the war on terror, where at the highest levels of the administration, officials were justifying very, very tough and unprecedented kinds of interrogations.
Well, and Senator McCain, who certainly has some experience about prisoner of war issues, said it wasn't plausible that soldiers would abuse prisoners without being instructed to do so, and he said he intends to get to the bottom of it.
Yeah, well, I think it's not really plausible. I mean, if you look at a couple of those photos, particularly one we cite in our article, perhaps the most iconic photo to come out of this scandal is the fellow standing on the box, you know, who's hooded and he's got wires attached to his extremities. That is a well-known torture interrogation technique that that people who know interrogation, you know, professionals in the business, recognize. It actually has a name. It's called the Vietnam. And the idea that, a group of MPs who had no training in this could have come up with that on their own is simply not plausible.
Michael, thank you.
Okay.
Michael Hirsch is a senior editor with Newsweek magazine. He joined us from Washington, D.C. Israeli tanks are sealing the Rafah refugee camp in the Gaza Strip today as part of a major offensive. Palestinians are continuing to flee their homes. More than 2,000 have left in the day since Israel's top court ruled that the military can continue to destroy dwellings to protect its soldiers' lives. The Israeli army chief has said that hundreds of homes are marked for demolition. For more on the situation now, we're joined by Christian Science Monitor correspondent Ben Linfield. He was in Gaza yesterday, and he joins us from Jerusalem. Welcome, Ben.
Thank you very much.
Ben, it seems a little puzzling that even as Israel's Prime Minister Ariel Sharon is trying to push for an Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, this demolition is happening. How are we to understand this?
Well, on the surface, it does seem a bit puzzling, but actually, if you looked at the details of Ariel Sharon's withdrawal proposal from Gaza, the withdrawal referred to the 7,500 Jewish settlers who live in Gaza among 1.3 million Palestinians. It never really spelled the end of Israel's military involvement in Gaza. Israel was to keep the Philadelphia corridor along the border with Egypt, where the massive home demolition is now planned and indeed actually started between Wednesday and Friday. And Israel is also going to keep control of all movement from the sea and from the air. In addition to that, Prime Minister Sharon made clear during his campaigning for the referendum in the Likud party that Israeli military actions would be even more intensive, and they have been extremely intensive over the last 3.5 years, but he said they would be even more intensive if there were Palestinian violence in Gaza, which means that the Israeli tanks would roll right back into the strip when the military deemed it necessary.
Well, and as you write, one of the objectives here is to thwart some of these tunnels that have been built underground and allowed weapons to come into the Palestinian area from Egypt.
Right. What the army officials are saying is that the house demolitions are to thwart smuggling in underground tunnels. The demolitions, however, take place on a very large scale, and the Palestinian view is that the Israeli idea is simply to clear out the border area that would make it absolutely impossible for the Palestinians to control their own border and to create basically a sterile zone without inhabitants in that area.
And what has been the Palestinian response to all of this?
The response on the ground has been many people packing up, taking whatever belongings they can, and getting out of the way of what they see as an inevitable onslaught of bulldozers. And diplomatically, Palestinian Prime Minister Ahmed Karay raised it in a meeting with Condoleezza Rice, asking the United States to intervene and stop the demolitions. We should point out that the United States is on record as opposing these demolitions. Colin Powell said so as much yesterday during remarks in Jordan.
And also Condoleezza Rice reaffirmed the U.S. position that there should be a two-state solution there. And then there was a huge peace demonstration in Israel this weekend. What was that all about?
It was pretty much a left and also a centrist Israeli rally, with Shimon Peres being one of the keynote speakers. The slogan of the rally was withdraw from Gaza and begin to negotiate, as opposed to the government's line that there is no one to negotiate with on the other side.
Ben, thank you.
All the best.
Ben Linfield is Christian Science Monitor correspondent, speaking to us from Jerusalem. Still to come, a new documentary about same-sex marriage made by a filmmaker trying to tie the knot with his partner. You're listening to Here and Now. As we've been reporting, today marks the first day of same-sex marriages in Massachusetts. Among those seeking a marriage license in Cambridge last night were Florida residents Catherine Baker and Kim Emery. But they were turned away at 4:30 a.m. this morning because, as we mentioned earlier, Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney is enforcing the 1913 law that prevents the state from giving marriage licenses to couples whose home state doesn't recognize them. Well, Catherine and Kim join us on the line now from Somerville, Massachusetts. Kim, let's start with you. Last night, as I said, you were at Cambridge City Hall. What time did you head there, and what was your expectation?
Well, we headed there pretty early because we were there to see our friends from Somerville file their application. But it wasn't until about 11:30 that we were informed it might be possible for us to apply there as well.
So they told you that it might be possible. Catherine, did you? Was this a surprise to you?
Well, kind of. We just weren't sure. We've been taking a wait-and-see attitude, and we were there, and we had our paperwork with us, and we kind of got swept up in the excitement and thought we'd give it a try there.
Right. So, Kim, what happened when you got to the counter?
Well, when we finally got downstairs at 4:30 in the morning, the clerk was very nice, very polite, but when she noticed on our applications that we both resided in Florida now and intended to continue residing in Florida, she informed us that it wasn't possible for her to process the application.
Now, I know one of you, when we spoke earlier this morning, had indicated that the clerk was trying to help you perhaps move to Massachusetts or somehow be in Massachusetts. What happened?
It felt a little bit like that. It felt like she was giving us the benefit of the doubt, and we could have said that we intended to live here. But we really wanted to tell the truth.
Right. So now you've headed over to Somerville, and what happened there?
It was great. Everything went very smoothly. There wasn't much of a line. We filed our application. They handed us a notice informing informational notice to out-of-state couples, but processed the application with no problem. And there was a couple from Gainesville in line right behind us.
Now, Somerville is one of the towns, for those who are listening out of Massachusetts, it's right next to Cambridge, but this is a town that's declared that it's going to overrule the governor. Kim, are you worried, first of all, you have a town in Massachusetts overruling the governor's advocating of a 1913 law, and then you're heading back to Florida, which does Florida have a defense of marriage law that will bar your marriage there?
Florida has a Defense of Marriage Act, but I think the legal situation is fairly ambiguous there, so I'm not certain that law recently passed will stand judicial scrutiny.
All right. Do you worry that your marriage in from Somerville might lead you to a court case in Florida? What will you do? And how will you know if your marriage isn't legal?
That's a good question, how we'll know. I don't think we're worried about a court case, and it's possible that we might pursue one. But, yeah, I'm worried about how we're supposed to file our income taxes next year.
Right. That may be the telling point. Well, in the meantime, do you plan a wedding?
Well, on Thursday, we're going to have our wedding somewhere here in Massachusetts. We haven't figured out where. We're thinking maybe the Arlington Street Church.
And, Catherine, let me just ask you, with all of this, I mean, your friends, you say you have friends here, but why are you doing this, traveling all the way from Florida to Massachusetts, going from Cambridge to Somerville, going back to a state that may be hostile to your marriage here? In just a few seconds we have, why are you doing it?
Well, I guess it's kind of symbolic. We've been together almost 16 years, and I've always wanted to marry Kim. I think it's important. I've always felt married to her, and this is the first opportunity we've had to try to do something that might actually be legal eventually.
Mm. We think it's pretty telling that they're enforcing a outdated racist law in order to try to enforce a discriminatory practice now, and we're confident that in the long run.
Well, thank you both.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Needless to say, we'll be hearing more debate around the issue of same-sex marriage in the future. But the controversy has a rich history as well, and that's been documented in a new film, Tying the Knot, The Union That's Dividing America. The documentary begins with the takeover of the city clerk's office in New York City back in 1971.
Holly, this is definitely the marriage bureau, but it's been taken over by the Gay Activist Alliance. Your mother and dad want to get married? Are they gay? Oh, I'm sorry, we can't help you.
Goes to Canada, where same-sex marriage is legal in some provinces.
Hi, Pam.
Hi, Pam.
Take thee, Jenny.
Take thee, Jenny.
To be my wedded spouse.
To be my wedded spouse. For better or for worse.
For rich or for poor.
For rich or for poor.
In sickness and in health.
In sickness and in health.
I now pronounce you to be legally married spouses.
And finally travels to the Massachusetts State House, where opposition to today's new law had been loud and clear.
Are these Christian values you're teaching your children?
Yes, they are teaching me because I know the right.
Tying the Knot just premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival in New York City. We talked to filmmaker Jim DeSav about what began as a very personal exploration of same-sex marriage.
You know, it started, I was looking at my own life and looking at my own relationship and wondering, you know, at a point, you hit a point, I think, in your 30s where you start thinking about committing and settling down and all that sort of stuff. And I'd been together with my partner for about 2 years. And I wanted to use film, I wanted to use a documentary as a form of helping me to explore and understand that whole process, what it was all about. Mm-hmm. As I started investigating and I started realizing the depth and scope of what marriage, and particularly civil marriage as an institution, is, and the ways in which people are allowed into that institution or denied from being allowed into that institution, I realized that there was a much bigger, deeper story that went well beyond myself.
Right. In fact, you pretty much talk about the history of marriage itself and also include things like early marriage was not for love but for survival.
People were marrying in order to share resources, in order that they can survive and share farms and property and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah. In fact, there was a great proverb mentioned, he who marries for love has good nights and bad days.
Yeah.
But also tell us just a little bit, because you had footage of the famous mixed race couple case in Virginia in the 1950s. How was that analogous to your story?
When I started hearing the arguments that were put forward to support anti-miscegenation laws, and once I started hearing the arguments that are put forward to support laws that deny gays and lesbians from marrying, I started seeing the parallels, and they're very clear. And we have a very nice Evan Wolfson, who's the head of a project in New York, centered in New York, called Freedom to Marry, does a great piece in the film where he explains the Loving versus Virginia story and then goes into all of the arguments that were made at the time. And what we were able to do was to go into the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act debates in Congress and find people saying exactly the same things that had been said in the 1950s and 1960s.
They argued that if we allowed interracial couples to marry, society would fall apart.
If marriage goes, then the family goes. And if the family goes, we have none of the decency or ordered liberty which Americans have been brought up to enjoy and to appreciate.
They argued that it would be bad for the children.
Should we tell the children of America that in the eyes of the law, the parties to a homosexual union are entitled to all the rights and privileges and benefits that have always been reserved for a man and a woman united in marriage?
They argued that it would be unfair to different states that didn't want to allow these kinds of couples to marry.
No one state of the union can have its decision of its people overridden, run roughshod by people from, judges from another state.
They made very much the same kinds of arguments that we hear today made to defend sex discrimination in marriage.
It really makes you realize that it has so little to do with gays and lesbians marrying and so much to do with finding scapegoats. And we were just becoming the scapegoats in this instance.
Hmm. Threading through the film are the stories of two same-sex couples. There's Sam, who was married to a woman and had a family, then fell in love with Earl. Earl died after they'd been together for 22 years. At one point in the film, you ask Sam what was the difference between his two relationships.
Other than sex, not one damn thing.
Except that There was a big difference. Earl had left his chicken farm to Sam. The will was contested in court, and there are just heartbreaking scenes where Sam talks about losing his property because Earl's relatives contest the will, and they're able to do that because he has no grounds to stand on.
I had come across this story through the ACLU here in New York, and Sam, I gave him my number, and Sam called me up and said, you know, I'd be interested in being in this documentary. And I said, well, Sam, it could be even dangerous for you to be in this documentary because you live in rural Oklahoma. He said, well, you know, that doesn't matter. If other people can be educated about what I'm going through or that we can change the situation, even in places like this, you know, I'm willing to be in the film.
And what also was touching was here are his, Sam's, big, burly children, adult children, yeah. Obviously so supportive of the partnership between Sam and Earl.
Well, I consider they were married. I mean, lived together 22 years. That's pretty much married. I rarely see very many straight marriages. You go past 15 years, usually they just one another, start killing each other. Occasionally you see the old couples have been married 35, 40 years. That's the way I felt. They were married, it was nothing to it. Just parents to me.
That was an eye-opener to me, and I think to everyone who will see the movie, is to see these guys who are, you know, self-described rednecks, if I can use the term, sitting there with their baseball hats and their NASCAR shirts on, talking about their father being in love with another man and having grown up with this other man.
What happened to Sam?
Sam's case is still in appeal.
Okay.
He's still on the farm. I talked to him not too long ago. And it's in the appellate courts in Oklahoma, so we've yet to see what will happen.
Can you find some place where you understand those people who passionately think that marriage should just be between a man and a woman, and it strikes at the core of their beliefs?
Yeah, you know, in making this film, you can't avoid that. And it was kind of funny because at some point I tell friends of mine, you know, I was watching some of the footage from the Christian right, and I found myself sitting there going, well, maybe they're right. Maybe marriage is only between a man and a woman. You know, that is what marriage is, right? On the other hand, for the religious right, and it's mostly the voices of the religious right, for them to come and say all of the benefits that, you know, tax-paying heterosexuals get should not be given to tax-paying homosexuals is just outrageous. So, you know, I do understand it from the religious point of view, but I don't know that those people really understand the depth and the scope of marriage. And, you know, that's something that I hope to illuminate with the film.
Mm. Well, the debate, as we said when we started, is going to continue, even with this decision in Massachusetts. It's just one state. But I'm wondering, are you and your partner planning to get married here in Massachusetts?
The question of the hour. We, you know, we were actually debating the other night if we should go to Toronto or to Massachusetts. And our legal advice, because Kian, who's my partner, one of the co-producers in the film, is from Indonesia. So we have the binational sort of crisis and problem that, you know, you never know if he'll be allowed to stay in the country or not. He's here as an asylee.
It's just so interesting. So, you're a gay couple and you're binational.
Yes. Yes, exactly. So for our own marriage, we may end up, and I've promised my mother that we wouldn't elope. We may end up running off to Toronto. I guess it's not eloping if I'm announcing it on the radio.
I guess not. Yeah. Better call Mom.
Yeah, exactly.
Jim, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Filmmaker Jim DeSev's documentary is called Tying the Knot, The Union That's Dividing America. Same-sex marriage became legal in the state of Massachusetts today.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Mike Toda. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our intern is Nick Weiss-Richmond.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again. Here and Now. Thank you. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.